From deep in the wilds of Pittsfield Township, Michigan, it's the Grace and Paul Pottscast. She's a left-wing conservative Catholic homeschooler who loves to garden. He's a bearded computer geek who reads and writes like he's running out of time. Together, they're raising an ever-growing army of adorkable children and planning the revolution.
Hello!
Those are the wilds.
Those are the wilds. Yeah, we were supposed to have actual sound effects and whatnot. We have a very low production budget right now.
We keep planning on recording the coyotes outside, but it doesn't happen.
We have had coyotes, real coyotes outside. Anyway, we have a guest. This is Anna.
Anna Marco.
Hi, everyone.
Yeah, welcome to the show, Anna.
And you're where
Thanks
now?
For having me.
You're where now?
I live in New York City. I live in Brooklyn. I also am one of the hosts of the Breadline podcast, the leftist food podcast that just kicked off recently.
Right on.
We will put a link in the show notes.
To your podcast.
Yeah. And thanks. You are a millennial and you work now as a pastry chef. Is that right?
I do. Yeah. So I work in restaurants. I make the fancy, expensive plated desserts in a restaurant, which is it drives me nuts that it's something that not everybody can afford to enjoy, but it fulfills a creative need for me. So
it's a very basic pleasure.
Wait,
you know?
It's incredibly satisfying to work with my hands and create something, and also as somebody who really loves fruits and vegetables, to do as little as possible to a perfect piece of fruit or something
kind
of one of the best pleasures there is, you know, to capture the essence of something in a sorbet or an ice cream, or just to simply roast a peach or something. It's kind of really nice to appreciate, to get the opportunity to appreciate what people grow. More than I would otherwise.
Now, we took the opportunity to have a nice meal before this podcast,
right?
So we wouldn't spend it salivating.
We made sure that we ate a filling meal, because we knew that if you started talking about desserts, we'd be like drooling on our microphones.
We're like, what, 3 minutes in, and I'm already in trouble. Roasted peaches.
Yeah. So we'll also share. You put pictures of some of your creations on Instagram. Is that?
I do. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm on Instagram and Twitter, both as Very Small Anna. Instagram I use more professionally. It's just almost entirely work photos, finished products, and then Twitter. Right. You know, you get to listen to me yell at people about politics, but also get a lot more stream of consciousness and pictures of things as I'm working on them and ideas being bounced around. So it's
I approached you for the show and all this entirely on the basis of happening to stumble across you on Twitter and then following a link to your podcast and listening to that, and I'm like, I should talk to this person.
I'm glad you did. We had a good conversation about food, and I'm really excited that we're doing that podcast. I was so happy when I was contacted by Matthew, the guy who puts everything together, because he wanted to start it.
So tell me a little. I haven't heard the podcast. Tell me a little bit about it. What's it about?
So every episode is about the intersection of food and politics from a leftist perspective. So that's a lot how the entire food network is connected, and all food is inherently political. People don't want to talk about that very much, you know, but it's like, you know that everybody knows now that, you know, the way we're cracking down on immigration is causing problems with crops getting harvested. Climate is causing problems to what we're growing. Growing zones are changing. Right now we've got, for example, just today I saw articles about how the smoke from the wildfires in California is inhibiting the sunlight from reaching crops and allowing them to ripen fully.
Wow.
There's also the issues of apparently a lot of poultry farms in North Carolina are literally underwater right now, as well as all of the pig farms with their runoff lagoons.
Manure lagoons.
It's a serious, disgusting problem. Yeah. Which, I mean, they shouldn't have existed in the first place.
Right?
We all know this. Yeah.
We all know this. But they do. And now we have a public health problem.
Yeah,
right.
That's the kind of stuff we talk about, how, you know, and we dig a little deeper too, and we get some interviews and we get some good quotes and encourage a lot of audience participation. We want people to call us and to direct message us and just help us dig a little bit deeper on any given topic, because there's always more we can say about everything we talk about.
Mm-hmm. I think it was in the first show, I forget which one of you did this, but basically one of you rattled off a list of topics. Mm-hmm. And it was like,
he had a handwritten list that he sent us a photo of,
right,
that he wrote out, and it was exhaustive.
Yeah, and if you unpacked all those topics, all of which were closely related to both food and politics, of course, that like would be years of shows, right? Years. You know, they could be spin-off shows. So.
Right. I mean, we've only technically, our first episode was an intro, so technically we only have two real episodes, and the newest one is one of two because we started talking about food assistance, and there was just so much more to say than.
Right.
And we try to keep the episode short, but there was just too much. So there's a second episode coming out very soon about that.
They did a show about food in prisons too, which I know very little about, but is I think a topic people really do need to hear about.
It was that was really enlightening. There was a lot of I enjoy doing research for the show to really dig deep on a topic and see, you know, what we don't know about something and we got several people for that episode actually messaging us saying that they went to a certain prison and that's what it was like, and we eventually got in contact with one of them to record something for us, and it was just heartbreaking.
It was I mean, like, you know, it's sort of cliche to say that something is gripping, but you know, I listen to a lot of podcasts at work while I'm on the computer all day, and most of them I can continue to work, but some of them I'll just like stop and stare, you know. And that was one of the stop and stare into space, like, wow.
That was heavy. I remember getting sent the audio file for what that guy said. I had just left the movie Sorry to Bother You, actually.
Oh, really?
And Matthew sent me that, and I was just walking down the street listening to it, just like had to stop for a second. I was like, that's He broke down so many things we didn't even talk about. Like, he was in Alaska, and the local indigenous population, they're still eating their traditional diet up there, and then you throw them in prison, and they have to subsist on cup noodles and moldy bread, and that's a huge unhealthy shock to someone's system.
Yeah, of course.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And. Wow.
Okay, so we'll include links to that podcast.
And mind you, there are people, some of them may be listening, that enjoy cup of noodles.
Sure.
Right?
That's not the point.
That's not the point.
It's different when that's the only thing you can buy from the commissary to supplement what the inedible things that they're giving you.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You wouldn't, you know, even the people who like to eat that for lunch, you wouldn't probably enjoy having it
daily,
every day.
Three meals a day.
I did recently see a piece about a formerly incarcerated man who started a business selling like cup noodles to prisons that have much lower sodium, which is a huge Band-Aid, but at the same time, he is doing something materially.
Yeah, it's a start.
It improves the lives of prisoners. So, you know.
And as a side note, there are people being paid to serve the food that's inedible.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and then the prisoners have to buy food they can eat.
It's
an interesting little setup.
Yeah. It's worse than that in some places.
It's a whole little...
I believe the term is racketeering. I think racketeering is the term.
Yeah, it is. I mean, they're designed to generate revenue, the companies that run the commissaries, and they're the same companies that run the cafeterias. And if they can make the food inevitable, so the prisoners end up buying things from the commissary, that's built into the system.
It's a win both ways.
That's what it's designed to do.
And then I know they sell their families incredibly marked up things they can ship as care packages.
Right. There's, the care package. They have a huge markup on the products. It's two or three times as much, but you have to get it through their vendors. And they're doing the same thing with a lot of books and just restricting access to anything that's not through an approved vendor, which is really just a great metaphor for the way society's going at this point.
Yes, exactly.
And they have no choice. That's their only access to anything.
Right. And
this scam that's come the surface recently about, was it a sheriff in Alabama is running basically funneling his food budget into a home, like a beachfront, a house, or
it's an antiquated law that's still put into practice where instead of
it's legal
funding. Yes, so it's from when. From like the 30s, even when the sheriff and his wife used to have the jail attached to their home because they'd only ever house like 2 to 3 prisoners at a time.
Right.
And the sheriff's wife would cook the meals for everyone.
And they'd get a stipend.
So that's still the law there, is that they're just paid personally to provide for the inmates.
Right.
But they personally have control of the money. It goes into their account. It does not go into the
state budget or prison budget.
Yeah,
and anything they didn't actually spend on food, he was allowed to just skim off and use for his own purposes.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to court now. That guy has a lot of allegations against him, including some sexual assault allegations. So he's obviously a real winner.
I'm shocked.
But it's just crazy that it's such an old law and it's being abused so flagrantly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and most of this stuff is like, you know, I consider myself kind of plugged into, you know, left media and all that, but some of it's still, you know, I'm still capable of being shocked and learning new things all
shocked
the time as stuff comes up. And the prison strike is helping to shed
a lot of
light
and
share a lot of information about conditions for inmates. So.
I think officially the strike is technically over at this point. It was a certain span of time.
Yeah, I think it ended September 9th.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it did help. There was a lot more visibility going on with issues.
Mm-hmm.
I think at this point now they just started to lay down extra charges or whatever for the prisoners who were
on strike.
The ones who were victimized by the riot in South Carolina that inspired the whole strike, where the guards basically instigated and then looked the other way, and now of course they're going to punish the prisoners for it.
Yeah.
So I don't know a ton of details on what's developing with that, but I know they're now that the strike's over, they're going to start cracking down on a lot of the people who participated.
Yeah,
well. Which is to be expected. But.
Right.
Yeah. Well, if we want to back up maybe, and maybe you'd like to give us a little background on sort of how you got to where you are, like how you navigated your upbringing and your early life and career, because this is part of a series on millennial economics, and we're interested in how this, like most screwed of generations, is getting by and faring. And also, I think we would like to make this a resource for maybe other millennials who might, you know, get some inspiration or ideas or
inspiration, insight,
any insight. Yeah.
Or just, you know, some companionship on the journey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So whatever you'd like to share about sort of like how you got to where you are.
Okay. I'm from Maine originally, and I grew up in a pretty liberal household. My parents were always into the idea of like a co-housing or commune group, but it never really worked out. So they ended up buying a nice house and starting a garden in the back, which is a nice way to settle. Mm-hmm. So I grew up with that. I'm not really a gardener myself.
I'm kind of
more of a seek and destroyer in the garden because I will totally harvest everything, but I don't know how to keep it alive.
Don't underestimate that role. That's a critical role. Yeah.
It is. No, you send me out to water and you're going to have half as many sugar snap peas as you did. Everything's water. So
Grace and I were very trying to get engaged in local co-housing stuff going on in Ann Arbor years ago, yeah, shortly after we met. Yeah, yeah. So we're kind of familiar with,
yeah,
with that stuff. Yeah.
It's tricky. They tried something. I mean, when I was 6 years old, this is something I've been thinking about a lot lately, because I do not want to stay in this city forever. Mm-hmm. Is when I was 6 years old, we went out on a family trip to Santa Fe, New Mexico. We went to Colorado a little bit too, but we were mostly in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. Because of there were the Earth ships that some guy was building out there.
Yeah.
They were made of plastic bottles, tires, and stucco. I really want one now.
That's some serious hippie stuff right there. Yeah,
yeah, we went out to see that when I was 6 years old, but the landscape has stuck with me ever since. It's the most beautiful place I've ever been. I really want to go back.
It's marvelous, yeah.
Yeah, so there was that, and then there was a group back in Maine that had a big tract of land out in the middle of the state, in the middle of nowhere. Like, a lot of people don't realize how big Maine is and how much the population is concentrated in the very tiny bottom coast.
And the map is distorted. It doesn't really show how big it is.
And then the rest of it is just
forest and mountain.
It's just empty forest and the top of the Appalachian Trail, which is a totally different part of the state than where I'm from. There's parts of Maine where nobody speaks English because they're all Quebecois. They all speak French. Like, I have friends I have a good childhood friend whose dad didn't speak English till he was like 10 years old or something like that. Like, it's a strange state. But yeah, anyway, we were involved with a group out there, and I think they were just taking too long, and they were, to my recollection, were a little cultish. So my parents hit the brakes on that one. And before we had our own house, they were renting farmland and growing stuff too. So that was something they were always interested in. And it was a great way to grow up, to kind of grow up with a lot of Green Party meetings in my living room, and Peter, Paul, and Mary playing all the time and stuff. That's the sound of my childhood.
that was early even for Peter, Paul, and Mary. So, I mean, that would have been your parents' music.
Absolutely was. So that's how I grew up. And then as I got into high school, realized that I didn't... It was in advanced classes, but I hated academia, and everyone was being pushed into, you get to the point in high school where you realize everything is just college prep. I was like, that seems like a trap, and there's nothing else.
It's more
and
so.
There's like nothing else.
Yeah,
and it was more so for your generation. It was a little less so for my generation.
Yeah, it's definitely a newer phenomenon, is how at least the second half of high school, and I'm sure it starts even earlier now. It's just college prep and assuming that everybody's going to go to college and get a textbook education.
It's all standardized testing and STEM now.
Oh God, all the standardized tests. By the time I was in high school, I was just writing essays that were basically comedy bits. I was trolling at an early age. it's no wonder
14,
that I
already trolling.
I was lucky enough to have teachers who basically were like, "We're gonna pass you anyway. We know you don't care. It's fine. It's cool." I ended up getting my diploma through the state instead of my high school because they required like less math credits or something. And I was like, "What do I even need geometry for? That's not like it passed." Past level two, this is really, I'm not going to be an engineer. We all know this. So, so I did that. And then I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do with my life. I worked, I went and I was really lucky. And then I had a college fund from my grandparents. And I took some money out of that and I bought a car and I got a job and I worked in retail for the next 5 years. And I had a safety net that a lot of people my age and younger just didn't have, which is gone now because I used the rest of it to go to pastry school once I realized that was a thing.
Right, right.
I was thinking about going to, after those 5 years, I was thinking about going to either art school or cooking school. And then I found out that pastry chef was a job you could have. I
cool. You can do that.
Didn't know that.
You could like bake cookies for a living.
Right, right. Like that was my favorite thing to do. I was cooking a lot at home and I was like, well, if I can do this for a living, that would be ideal. So I ended up spending everything that was left to move to the city and start taking classes at a pastry school and mm-hmm. worked my way up from there.
What is a pastry school? Really, is that part of a culinary institute or?
It was a 6 month program. There are actual colleges that are 2 and 4 year degree programs. This was just a 6 month certificate. Mm-hmm. They just had a really great job placement nice. Program, right. And so it was really easy to get a good internship and to get help. You know, you can contact them anytime and they'll help you out. They're still great like that.
Mm-hmm. So you come out of that program and then you're ready to intern with the restaurant? Is that the...
Oh, you're ready to hire. You're ready to be hired.
Yeah, I did an internship during my last few months there. My last 2 to 3 months, I did an internship at a local Michelin starred restaurant, which is the fanciest of the fancy restaurants and the fanciest place that I I literally haven't worked at a Michelin starred restaurant since. So that was the fanciest place I've ever worked in, technically. Mm-hmm. I just kind of worked in small restaurants after that, which unfortunately the problem with that is a small restaurant, when they're having problems making ends meet, usually because the landlord has jacked your rent again, which is a huge problem here in the city now, the first department they cut is pastry because they decide it's not important.
It's not critical.
So I've literally had my desserts eliminated twice.
Right.
Over the course of my career. And they were departments where I was the only one running it. They're just like, we're just gonna get rid of you and your department. It's like, thanks. Okay. I thought I'm like have fun filling all those special cake requests for the next month. Yeah.
Good luck with that.
Not my problem now, I guess.
right.
But yeah, it's tricky. It's kind of, it's interesting in that I'm doing something that I love doing that makes me happy, that I get to work with my hands and create something that is the most tangible that you can create, mm-hmm. and that it can be consumed, and it's there just to make people happy. At the same time, it's something that is overpriced, and for the most part, I am feeding people that I wouldn't like, help on the street because I know they're so wealthy that they don't care about me. Like it's sad that I want to feed my friends and I cannot. They cannot afford it.
Maybe fair. We will. I was thinking about reading a passage from Orwell's Down and Out in Paris and London to talk
that
about.
That is a great book.
Well, okay, so you're familiar with it. So maybe I'll pull that out after
this
section.
It was recommended to me at one of my first jobs by a waiter.
Oh, really?
Read this.
He said that the passages about all the cooks sweating in the basement reminded him of me.
Yeah.
Which is very, very, very apt.
Yeah. You've probably also read Kitchen Confidential then, right?
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah, Kitchen Confidential struck me as just sort of a updated version of Down and Out in Paris and London in a way. And Orwell gets into some specific political insights as well, you know, so... But and sorry, I don't want to derail you. But we're working in pastry departments that were shut down because of, like you say, the rents in all cities now are a huge problem. Yeah, the rent is too damn high.
it's crazy.
It's not just New York City. It's even in Ann Arbor, Michigan. You know, like the restaurants that I grew up loving. You know, the hole in the wall places. Most of them are gone.
Oh, the best holes in the wall are all gone.
Yeah, or they've left for like strip malls way on the outskirts of town.
I mean, funny enough, back in my hometown, a lot of the restaurants, a lot of the good restaurants that have been there since I was a kid are still there. There's just more restaurants. The old ones don't go away. They stay there, but there's more now. And it's kind of insane how many restaurants there are per capita up in a lot of the bigger towns and the cities in Maine. Like,
really?
It's like Portland, Maine has the most breweries per capita in the entire country. Yeah. Everybody goes there to everybody moves up there to open restaurants. It's relatively cheap. It's a very seasonal business, but you still have locals year round. Mm-hmm. You have access to all the best seafood and stuff like that. So
Maine has an amazing food culture. Mm-hmm. I'm from
it
Southern.
Really
New,
does.
Yeah, I'm from Southern New England. So you know, I've got a taste of Maine. We used to drive up.
She spent some time up there.
Yeah, and really, what I've discovered over the last 30 years is that Maine has decided that they're doing tourism. Like, you know, like some states like have it as part of their thing, as part of their like portfolio. Maine's doing it. They're all in.
Well, you can hardly up, help it because everybody's already coming up there for the summer anyway.
They're there anyway. Right. It's
so
built in.
There's no reason. Yeah. It's just, you just have to accept it. Working in retail, we got used to it. It's, you know, you would have your busy holiday season, but the summer would be tourist season and you would make a lot of money.
As much as the holiday season.
You just have to know that you are also playing tour guide to the customers. You know, you'd have people coming in and I worked in a record store in my hometown and I had people coming in and asking like where they could get some really nice craft beer. And I sent them to my favorite place and they came back the next day to tell me it was great. But it is living in the town means that you are everybody's tour guide.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
At some point, somebody's going to ask you for a recommendation, and you better know where
you better
to
know.
Send them because you're going to see them again next year. They're going to come back.
You'll see them again. And I think, like, Maine's embraced it. Mm-hmm. A lot of places are kind of...
They don't, it's...
like, Massachusetts doesn't embrace it.
Locals don't like it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, no. I mean, I would say that nobody really likes having a tourist season, but the fact that the economy is so dependent on it, and that everybody... I mean, I don't really visit up there outside of the summer or the warmer months, at least, just because it's so miserable in the winter.
Yeah.
So I've become a tourist too. Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm wondering though, like, so how do you feel the economy is treating you, given all that's come to pass and the ups and downs of having departments close? And, you know, having to find new work, et cetera. What's your sort of like a one sentence takeaway? How's the economy treating you? And then kind of unpack that.
I'm basically currently stuck at my current job because there are no other viable jobs. I'm not crazy about the restaurant group that I'm working for, which if you did any digging, you could figure out who it is and why I might not be happy there. But there are really no other options.
And this is New York City.
This is New York City. Okay, there's no other options right now.
It's not Sandusky. Okay, just checking.
It's become almost a running joke that anytime I look at Craigslist or anything, for some reason, every steakhouse in the city is hiring a pastry chef and no one else is. And none of them need a pastry chef because their entire dessert menu is like a molten chocolate cake and some vanilla ice cream. And why do you need somebody who...
to make that
is usually you know, it's, they just want people to make like party cakes for VIP clients, and
it's
not that interesting, and I'm kind of at the point where a lot of the restaurants that are surviving and are doing really well are the ones that are catering to celebrity clients, and you're supposed to be wrapped up in that culture, and I did that at the beginning of my career, and I don't ever want to do it again. I genuinely don't care who's eating the food.
Right.
It doesn't matter to me. I'm gonna put it out just as nice for anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of, it's kind of annoying that that's how it is. People can't just go out for a nice night. They can't afford to. So you get the same regulars all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you get the VIPs, and it's just really it's stressful and annoying to be expected to be excited by it all the time. It's not exciting. People are people, and everybody needs to eat, and everybody wants ice cream sometimes.
The
economy is not great here. There's the rent situation. There's the fact that the market is simultaneously both too small and too big. There's too many people opening restaurants who have no business opening restaurants, which has always kind of happened.
Mm-hmm.
But now you've got with food being a big thing that people care about now, with celebrity chefs being such a huge thing, you have lots of kids going into culinary school and coming out and thinking they're ready to be a chef, and they're not. You really have to work a long time to know enough to run a kitchen.
Right. Yeah, Bourdain called it making your bones, all those years of making your bones.
Yeah, you do. You have to know what you're doing. You have to know every single station of the kitchen. You have to know a lot. It's not just technicality. It's not just can you butcher a chicken, can you cook a perfect steak? There's so much more to it. You know, there's costing, there's hiring, there's menu development. You know, when you develop a menu, you have to know how practical it is, if you can actually execute everything every time. So we've got the market flooded with people who are willing to take less money for more responsibility, and it leaves people who have more experience out in the cold. My husband's had a really hard time finding a job. We worked for a cafe for a while together after one of my departments closed, and the place ended up closing down. I don't really want to say unexpectedly. We weren't told in advance, but it wasn't surprising.
A little shock, yeah.
It was, we knew the owners were in debt. We knew they were trying to get another loan or get another partner to come on to help bail them out of the hole they were in. But basically, they were trying to renegotiate the lease, and the landlord said no. And the landlord said, I would rather get somebody else in here who's willing to pay more money off the bat. And they closed the place down. And because it's a landmark building, he couldn't get anyone to come in because you can't build any improvements on it. It's landmarked. And now he's just trying to sell it. So it's just been sitting empty for well over a year now.
Oh, this is hard.
And that's what's happening.
There's a lot of places heartbreaking.
I know.
They just sit empty forever, which is a huge contrast to going back to my hometown. And there are no empty storefronts. Everything is open and it's busy.
I hear that this is happening in London, in that everyone's just treating properties as investments. A lot of overseas investors.
That's a huge problem here. I read a great piece about it. It may have been in the New Yorker or something. It was this really long, in-depth piece about foreign investors coming into New York, and they're building new high-rises, and it's actually going to start killing Central Park because it's not going to get enough sun. They're apartments that are sold before they're even finished, and they're never lived in, ever. They're just assets. They are nothing but assets for people who don't live here. And they might come visit once a year, and that's it. It's bizarre.
No, that's sick.
The sound you hear in the background is me sharpening my guillotine blade.
As we all should. It's getting really bad. There are parts of the city where you walk around and you just see it. There are neighborhoods. I try not to go to the Lower East Side because it used to be, I've only lived here, I've lived here a little under 10 years, and it's still changed so much just in 10 years. Mm-hmm. It used to be such a great area. It's still a lot of a big nightlife neighborhood. You know, there's a lot of bars, but a lot of the places we used to go to eat at 3 a.m. aren't there anymore, and the blocks are completely demolished, and they're building high rises there. And there are places that are there that are landmarked, and they sold the air rights above them, so they are building on top of them. And it's just becoming a totally, totally different neighborhood. I think even the guy
Grace is making this facial expression like, that's a thing? What?
Yeah, air rights are a thing. Air rights are a thing, and you can sell them here. Everything is for sale here now. It's absurd. It's absolutely absurd.
And places that
have been here for so long, it's just like neighborhoods feel like they've been completely picked over, you know, and you walk uptown and you can kind of feel the, even before I worked on 60th Street right off of Billionaire Row for like 3 years. And even before I worked up there, I always got uneasy going up there. But if I go up there now, it's just like, I start like hyperventilating. It's just gross.
Wow.
You can feel it emanating from the buildings, how gross it is.
Feel the smarm. Yeah, that's disgusting.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah, so
it's a nice city. You know, why would you do that to a city? You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, it's things aren't changing and becoming different. They're changing and becoming homogenous. And it's really sad to see.
I remember, this was like maybe 20 years ago, my brother, we were talking about trying to figure out where we wanted to live and how we wanted to raise a family and all that. And my brother John was like, every place is the same.
It's like, yeah. No.
We
reject that.
Reject that.
Well, like, he had a point.
He had a point.
It's becoming the same.
Yeah. Yeah. So, do you think you're making it work? Do you think you can make it work?
I don't want to stay here. So that's the next step, is figuring out what to do next. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of being able to save the money to do it and having a plan, an exit strategy, because it's very hard to save money here.
There's a song in the musical Rent that goes, "We're opening a restaurant in Santa Fe."
Yeah,
something like that.
That's me.
Right. Your husband works in food too.
Yeah, he's had a hard time finding places. He keeps working for places and they keep closing.
Oh well, that's a thing. But yeah,
literally has happened 3 times in a row, and there's nothing to be done about it. There's nothing we can do about it.
Right. I mean, this thing's happened. I mean, this is. I'm not sanguine or what's the word? I don't think it's terrible. I don't think it's the worst thing. Mm-hmm. Lots of people open restaurants, and lots of them close.
Yeah, and right? Especially, you know, people.
Yeah,
like,
that's always been a thing.
There's always churn, and there's always people who start out who are more idealistic than sensible.
Right.
And mm-hmm. Bourdain called those like those people the chum of the restaurant business, because eventually you would get to like buy off there as they auctioned off all their fixtures and everything.
Right, there'd be the stuff, right?
There's no such thing as a restaurant that opens with 100% new furnishings.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
We all go and scavenge.
Scavenge the auction. Right.
So
the
pick it over.
And I think that's okay. I think that's fine that lots of businesses start. And even if 75% of them fail, 25% of them stick around and grow and develop and hopefully are healthy and functioning, right? And if they're engaging their workers in a moral way, then you know what? It's all good. It's all good.
But what happens when you add a whole rentier class on
that's
top of that?
That's when it gets ugly.
On everyone's neck.
That's where it gets nasty.
Most of the base models for restaurants don't involve treating the employees well.
Yeah.
Precisely, right?
So that's a problem, too. Really, really, to fix the industry, it has to be completely reformulated. There's the restaurants that have abolished tipping, which is usually a great start because that... there's always a lot of animosity from the kitchen to the front of the house because they have tips and they don't know enough to not brag about them in front of the cooks, and the cooks are making the same money no matter how many people you served.
Yeah.
You know, you have a night where you have 40 covers, you have a night where you have 120 covers plus a 40 person private party where the restaurant is making a ton of money off that party. Servers are making a ton of money off that party. Mm-hmm. Kitchen is making the same amount of money to
regardless.
Work 5 times as hard.
Ouch.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's
a very unequal system. And it needs to be fixed. And there are places that are doing it. There's a lot of, I've been reading about a lot of bakeries around the country that now have collective ownership.
Mm-hmm.
It's just as far as, my hometown is from here, but I really want to get out to Buffalo and visit the Bread Hive at some point. They're a collectively owned bakery.
Yeah, I've heard about this place.
Yeah, I mean, apparently their products are also absolutely amazing, but they are a worker-owned bakery. And, you know, I think that's the way to go. I personally do not want to own a business that is not collectively owned. I feel like that's unethical. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I feel like it's too much. That's the kind of thing where you end up getting pulled away and you're just running a business instead of making the food.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I always want to be making the food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I also would like to have more control over what's happening with the business.
Precisely.
Yeah. It's.
Yeah. I'm not sure that there's a moral arrangement that isn't worker owned. I'm not convinced that there is. I'm open to debate, but
right.
I don't think that there is.
Right.
Yeah. It's, you know, a democratically controlled workplace is the best outcome.
Right. And so that's when I sort of like demur and say, oh, it should be morally run. That's basically what I mean, right?
Mm-hmm.
I can imagine a family business possibly that could be moral. And
That's if it's something that's a lot like, of family businesses that have been passed down by generations and
are very closely held and have
That's a little bit different.
It's a little bit different.
You always have the risk of somebody in one of the younger generations saying, Let's franchise this.
Let's take this to the next level. And then it can get really ugly.
I've seen that. I've seen examples of that on like food TV and stuff where they're like, you know, oh, dad, why don't we sell blah, blah, blah? He's like, because we make it.
Why would we make it?
Why would we sell that to other people?
That's weird, right? And so, for my part, if hundreds of people want to get together and start a worker-owned bakery, restaurant, cafe, whatever, it's really okay. It's just fine. And some of them will fail, and some of them will succeed, and it's okay.
I think you learn something, you keep trying. You've got a structure of other places that have done it successfully to lean on.
Exactly.
Like, in California, I think somewhere there's a group that are – they share the same recipes, they have the same name, but each one is individually owned by the workers.
Precisely.
But they do support each other.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's basically
sort of like
the other ones.
An intellectual property infrastructure of how to do this. So you're not just going in cold. And I think if you iterate through that, like everybody comes, starts a business, you do that enough times, you know, you'll be cooking with gas after a while. It'll work itself out.
It is a process of normalizing that as a structure.
Yes, absolutely. That's,
it just needs to become more common, and people will begin to see. There's always people who would never adopt it because they want ownership and they don't want to share that with their workers.
To see more of them succeed
is good for everybody.
Right. It's good for everybody. But personally, I would want our legal environment to make the person that wants ownership. And to keep them in that space of family ownership, that they shouldn't be in this position where they're like, hey, let's see how many people we can exploit and how much money you can make with grandma's tomato sauce recipe. You know,
right.
That should never be.
Let's take grandma's tomato sauce recipe and jar it. And sell it at Walmart.
Right.
That doesn't work.
I don't know. The state needs to be in the business of enabling that. That just seems absurd to me. So all this is to say, some of this, like churn in the industry, is, you know, it happens, and it's tough to live through. It can be really tough to live through, but I think it's on this pathway to settling itself out, where people can find their way into some of this worker ownership and find their way into some of these more humane environments to work in. That you got to kind of like, you know, kind of like a dating relationship. You got to check a few people out before you find the right one. You know?
Yeah, you have to seek it out. At this point, you do have to seek it out, and you know that's kind of what I've been trying to do, is to get a feel for how more of them work. Like I said, I really want to go visit one and talk to the workers there and get some insight on how one might go about setting something like this up somewhere else.
Yeah,
doing other things, and you know that's my dream, is to have something like that where I'm just collaborating with a bunch of other. I kind of think of us as artists to make edible work
edible
for people.
Art? Yeah. No,
and
that's awesome.
That's, you know, that would be great. And just to have, you know, things, everything democratic. What are our specials today? That's democratic. Are we going to work with this farm? That's democratic, you know.
Right.
Just to support the actual community that we're in.
Awesome. I think Paul's got a, did you pick out a clip or?
Yeah, hang on.
He got quiet for a while. He went to get the book.
So, you were talking about luxuries, and this is a passage from Down and Out in Paris and London, from chapter 22, which is an amazing chapter, where he sort of stops telling the story and starts talking about like the philosophy the job he's describing was the plongeur, the sort of the lowest level kitchen staff, and it's not the cooks and chefs were steps up from this, but it's sort of applicable to like labor, you know, as
labor
a thing
in general.
So he says, is a plongeur's work really necessary to civilization? We have a vague feeling that it must be honest work, because it is hard and disagreeable, and we've made a sort of fetish of manual work. We see a man cutting down a tree, and we make sure that he is filling a social need just because he uses his muscles. It does not occur to us that he may only be cutting down a beautiful tree to make room for a hideous statue. I believe it is the same with a plongeur. He earns his bread in the sweat of his brow, but it does not follow that he is doing anything useful. He may only be supplying a luxury, which very often is not a luxury. And so he talks about a lot about how a lot of these luxury things are, no one really, it's they are status symbols rather than fundamental pleasures, basic pleasures of life. Similarly, with the plongeur, he is a king compared with a rickshaw puller or a Gary pony. But his case is analogous. He is a slave of a hotel or a restaurant, and his slavery is more or less useless. For after all, where is the real need of big hotels and smart restaurants? They are supposed to provide luxury, but in reality, they provide only a cheap, shoddy imitation of it. Nearly everyone hates hotels. Some restaurants are better than others, but it is impossible to get as good a meal in a restaurant as one can get for the same expense in a private house. So I don't know if this is, I'm not sure this is true in, you know, it's true in a sense.
In a sense. Yeah, no, it is.
But he's just spent the rest of the first, you know, two thirds of the book talking about what really goes on in the kitchen. And, you know, no doubt hotels and restaurants must exist, but there is no need that they should enslave hundreds of people. What makes them work, what makes the work in them, is not the essentials. It is the shams that are supposed to represent luxury. Smartness, as it is called, means in effect merely that the staff work more and the customers pay more. No one benefits except the proprietor, who will presently buy himself a striped villa at Deauville. Essentially, a smart hotel is a place where 100 people toil like devils in order that 200 may pay through the nose for things they do not really want. If the nonsense were cut out of hotels and restaurants, and the work done with simple efficiency, plongeurs might work 6 or 8 hours a day instead of 10 or 15. So he talks a lot about the reasons behind this excess work, right? And it's really the extraction of value. So this instinct to perpetuate useless work is at bottom simply fear of the mob. The mob, the thought runs, are such low animals that they would be dangerous if they had leisure. It is safer to keep them too busy to think.
I mean, it works. It works to this day.
Something to that,
Yeah. So the mass of the rich and the poor are differentiated by their incomes and nothing else, and the average millionaire is only the average dishwasher dressed in a new suit. Change places, and handy-dandy, which one is the justice, which is the thief? Everyone who has mixed on equal terms with the poor knows this quite well, but the trouble is that intelligent, cultivated people, the very people who might be expected to have liberal opinions, never do mix with the poor.
Not at all.
It talks about this generating ignorance. The educated man pictures a horde of submen wanting only a day's liberty to loot his house, burn his books, and set him to work minding a machine or sweeping out a lavatory. Anything, he thinks, any injustice, sooner than let that mob loose. He does not see that since there is no difference between the mass of rich and poor, there is no question of setting the mob loose. The mob is in fact loose now, and in the shape of rich men, is using its power to set up enormous treadmills of boredom, such as smart hotels.
Oh, dear. You may be onto something.
Anyway.
It's actually similar to something they mentioned in that article I was reading about the investors in New York, how a lot of the new buildings they are building are designed like a hotel and that you never have to leave. Full amenities on site.
Yeah.
Anything to wall themselves off from everybody else.
So, like, you just wouldn't walk outside for the sake of, I don't know, seeing the city?
No, you wouldn't. You'd have all of your your gym inside. You can get anything you want delivered in the city at this point. Your groceries, takeout, laundry, whatever. And they would have like indoor gardens. So you really wouldn't have to leave. You can get in a chauffeured car and go somewhere else and then come right back. That's
surreal.
Which is what's the point of living there?
It's not that far from a sealed up arcology that's, you know, 100 floors high where the people on the top never come down. So
well, that's where the air is good, you know?
Anyway.
Ouch.
So we're going to share some links. Do you want to tell us anything else about like
lessons, like parting thoughts or like, well,
What's a work day look like for you? Like you share these pictures where like I see your roasted apples and cool stuff like that. And I hear you talking about cardamom sauce and I'm drooling on my keyboard at work. But so what's a work day look like?
From beginning to end, most days I'm up between 6 and 7. I get to work usually by 8 a.m. Sometimes, some days I have to be in earlier, some days I have to be in later, but most days it's 8 a.m. I have to spin all of my sorbets. We melt them down at the end of the night and spin them fresh every day so they're nice and fluffy and creamy. Mm-hmm. Sorbets are the ones without dairy, but the ice creams stay in the freezer.
Yeah.
We have to bake focaccia twice fresh daily for every service. Mm-hmm. So I'm there for that. I have to go up to meetings twice a day before every before each service. So that's like 11:45 for lunch and 4 o'clock for dinner because we open at 4:30.
And then at those meetings, you're like telling people what you're serving, what specials.
Going over the specials, the flavors of the ice creams and sorbets for the day. Any changes to like the cheese plate, which I also do. There's a lot of things on my menu where the fruit just changes seasonally because we get a lot of stuff from local farms. So I tell them that. And then dinner service starts at 4:30 and I usually stay at least through the first seating of people, which because we're close to all the Broadway theaters is usually the busiest because everyone's eating before they go to a show.
Mm-hmm.
My average day ends up being between 12 and 14 hours.
Wow.
Okay.
And I'm salaried. So it doesn't matter. How long I stay.
You don't get overtime.
I make the same amount of money. I don't get overtime. I don't get tipped. I make the same every week no matter what. Mm-hmm. So my days are very, very long. And it's really hard to fit time in to do anything for myself or anything that's, you know, an interest outside of work. My commute is at minimum 40 minutes, 40 to 50 minutes each way.
God almighty, yeah.
So I usually take a walk after work because I just need to get outside and get in the air, get some exercise. I love walking around at night, so
yeah,
it's not, that's nice, but it's still, you know, and then the trains don't work half the time, so sometimes it takes me 2 hours to get home. Who knows? Thanks, right. Cuomo. That's how my days usually go. They're very long. If I'm lucky, twice a week, there's a nice older couple that comes from upstate with farm stuff. And I go outside and talk to them and they feed me some fruit and that's always kind of a highlight. So there are some nice perks to it, but normally I'm just in a basement for 12 hours a day.
Oh, good God.
Wow. Well, it's not, you're not working in a room with 6 open flames where it's 180 degrees like in Orwell's Day.
No,
but
not usually. Unless the city shut off the water tower again so I can't run the AC and then it gets pretty hot down there.
Gosh, okay. I can only imagine.
Yeah. So things have improved. I've been actually reading Down and Out in Paris and London to our kids for bedtime stories. I have to censor certain stories and passages.
Right.
And
some information.
There's a lot of anti-Semitism going on in some of his writing, but you know.
Yeah, I need to reread it. I haven't read it in a long time.
But they love like the graphic descriptions of
his work.
They're absolutely fascinated by this.
Yeah, the descriptions of the kitchens are amazing. It's still very accurate in a lot of restaurant kitchens.
Yeah.
Especially
he's describing at one point the job of handling, essentially he was handling room service with a whole bank of dumb waiters, where he had to slips of paper coming down and all this breakfast food and drinks and everything going back up.
Right.
And it describes, if you drop a piece of toast on the floor, what, you're going to make a new piece of toast? No, I don't think so.
Just saying.
Yeah. So now it's terrific. And I think material conditions for restaurant workers have improved somewhat. And sanitation has improved somewhat.
Yes, sanitation absolutely has. Yes. Yeah. It's crazy reading accounts of how a lot of restaurants back then used to do things, or in pastry reading about how a lot of the convents, like the Italian convents, were the ones who made all the sweets. Mm-hmm. And just the amount of work, like the physical power and labor that goes into producing things that we do with machines now is absolutely nuts. Mm-hmm. And to know that we're working so hard, and people back then also were working so much harder.
Right.
And do you feel there's no reason for it in either time.
In either context, right.
Do you feel is that gratifying to feel like this connection when you're making historic recipes and the traditions of cooking these dishes? Do you get into the old recipes?
I like to do a little research on why things are the way they are, and especially because I mostly have worked in Italian places. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of really interesting history behind a lot of dishes.
Yeah, I'm sure.
For example, we started serving a flourless chocolate cake, and it's called the Tenerina cake, and it's named after or in honor of the woman who was the queen of Italy, going into World War II. And she fled the country, but then she had a daughter named Mafalda who stayed behind and was eventually captured by the Nazis, and she died in a concentration camp. And the people of Italy named a pasta shape called Mafalda, Mafaldine after her. And we serve that at the restaurant too.
It's like Trump's tweets. There's always a pasta. Right?
There's always a pasta. Yeah.
There's so many Italian pasta shapes.
Yeah. So much is between Italy and France too, because neither of them can let the other one have anything culinarily. Ciabatta was invented because baguettes were becoming too popular, and the French were so mad that the Italians thought of Zabaione first. So it's very, very, and the only reason they have any good desserts at all in Italy is because they used to hire French pastry chefs. It's a very interesting, I do like throwing out the historical footnotes and giving people the reasoning behind stuff like that, and definitely digging into some of the more obscure, difficult recipes is a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. No. And I want to know, what would you say that you've learned that you'd want other millennials to know, other folks, trying to get by in the world today? Lessons learned, any sort of thoughts?
You don't have to do anything alone. It is very, very helpful to be able to reach out and share your experiences with other people. The obvious end point of that is to be able to form a union or something like that. But you don't have to take anything by yourself. You don't have to take anything alone. Right. There's always people who are in the same shoes you were, or they were, and there's always people that you can collectivize and form solidarity with. Always.
Right on.
Cool. All right. I think we're there.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day off to talk to us. Really appreciate it. It's been fun.
Thanks for having me. This was great. I was looking forward to it all day.
Cool.
Awesome.
Good. Okay. You've been listening to the Grace and Paul Podcast. Check out the show blog at podcast.blogspot.com, where you can leave comments or search for the Grace and Paul Podcast on Facebook or YouTube. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks a lot, Anna.
Thanks, Anna.
See ya.
All right, take care.
Yeah, thanks, guys.